Dr. David Von Nuys is Emeritus Professor of Psychology at Sonoma State University, where he served as the Psychology Department Chair for 7 years. He hosts a very popular psychology podcast called Shrink Wrap Radio. You can check it out at shrinkwrapradio.com. On this show, we're discussing the uses and abuses of market research, and David is well-equipped to provide good insights. He runs a market research consulting business at e-focusgroups.com, which has served a distinguished list of clients, including the New York Times, Apple Computer, IBM, Hewlett-Packard, and Quicken Loans, among others. He was also on the board of directors of the Qualitative Research Consultants Association and served as editor-in-chief for that organization's magazine, QRCA Views. And as you'll hear in our conversation, we go well beyond just focus groups and market research. It's really a wide-ranging conversation that draws on a lot of David's insights. Stay with us.
You're listening to Psych Talk.
Dr. David Von Nuys, it's a real honor to have you on Psych Talk. I've listened to your podcast for a while now, and you're one of the inspirations for my show, so it's nice to be speaking to you in person, or as a radio person, being voice to voice somehow feels like in person.
Yeah, well, it's my pleasure to be here, and I listened to your podcast, and I really enjoyed the episode that I listened to.
Well, thank you for that. So I think you have some insights that could really help at this question that Dan Ariely started challenging a bit on your show about, which is, when are focus groups useful? When are they not? And in general, when can market research be used and abused? Give us a thumbnail sketch of just your experiences with market research, and then we can start from there.
Well, you know, many years ago, I was in the process of still being a psychology professor at Sonoma State University. And at that point, I was already, I was already a full professor, and I was still fairly young. And so I was sort of thinking, well, is this it? Is this all there is? And it was about this time that the personal computer revolution started to take off. And I had initially planned to be an electrical engineer. And so I was kind of slapped myself on the forehead. No, I should have been an engineer, because I could see how much excitement and ferment there was starting to be with personal computers. I mean, Steve Jobs recently passed away, sadly. And I was right in there with an Apple IIe in the early days of computing, and could just see how big it was going to be. So I started to do some networking, looking for a way that I might participate in this new industry. And in the process of networking, I discovered actually focus groups. I had never heard of focus groups. I had never heard of qualitative research. I hadn't heard that term. But it turned out that a friend of a friend had been doing focus groups for Apple Computer and Atari, and as well as a bunch of packaged goods companies. And so he needed to expand his business a bit, and he needed some help. And so that's how I got into market research. And I found it very ironic that I had to get involved in the business world to discover qualitative research. Now, I was trained at the University of Michigan as a psychotherapist, which is qualitative by its very nature. But as you know, psychology has had a huge inferiority complex over its history, sometimes referred to as physics envy, wanting to be very scientific and very quantitative. And so, again, I was just struck by the irony of this very qualitative approach that seemed to have a history and actually to be accepted by the world of business. And first, as I began to do it, I was a bit skeptical. I started out writing reports. The fellow that I later was a partner with was doing the groups, and we would record the groups, and you know, he gave me a stack of his reports, and I was a good writer and imitator, so I picked up his style very quickly. So I was writing these reports, and basically, because I am a relatively good writer, I could weave a good story. So it involved kind of listening to what the respondents and the focus groups that either he was leading or later that I was leading, and putting that together with kind of common sense, intuition, and pulling what they were saying into a cohesive story.
What material were you working with there? You're writing these stories based on transcribed conversations or?
Yes, transcriptions of focus group interviews, conversations. Typically a conversation with anywhere from 6 to 10 people. And typically the focus groups would run for about 2 hours. So I became a believer after a while. I helped him steer his business more towards the technology sector because that's what I was particularly interested in. And by the way, in these early days, this was before I got into online focus groups. So these were all in-person focus groups. And so I was, you know, as I say, telling a good story in the form of a business report that was given to our clients. And what I realized eventually was that the business reports that I was writing were leading the computer press by about 6 to 8 months. In other words, the conclusions that we were drawing, the phenomena that we were observing, was later appearing in the news. And so it really turned me into a believer. And I realized that, yes, you can find out things about reality in non-quantitative ways by talking to people and letting them describe what their reality is and listening closely and drawing reasonable conclusions. As shocking as that may sound.
Talking to people?
Yeah, talking to people and listening and giving some credence. Now, focus groups and qualitative research generally, so there are other qualitative approaches, for example, one-on-one interviews, something that's happening right now or is what are called intentional research online communities that are formed with maybe 200 or 300 people who follow a brand or what's called scraping qualitative information from social networking sites like Facebook. Yes, they can do this. And drawing conclusions. So there are quite a few qualitative approaches, but I would say that focus groups are the largest segment. They have been historically, they continue to be so, despite a up and down history of being in favor, out of favor, in favor, out of favor. And I have to tell you, despite the criticisms of Dan Ariely and many others over the years, companies are still conducting focus groups. I seem to recall that it's on the order of about $4 billion a year on qualitative research. Pretty healthy industry.
Definitely. I was going past Wikipedia, so not the arbiter of all truth. It claimed, if you look at market research companies generally, not necessarily all qualitative. The way the article listed it was market research turnover, the size of industries in different continents. In North America, it was about $9 billion flowing around related to market research, companies like Nielsen.
Yeah, and so that's probably qualitative and quantitative combined. Quantitative being, you know, surveys.
Let's talk about that for a moment. When are surveys quantitative or qualitative, and how does that mix get decided?
Well, quantitative, of course, refers to things that can be counted, that can be quantified. And so those would be tend to be closed-ended questions on a survey where you're choosing between multiple options. So you've got true-false questions, multiple-choice type questions. Those are easily quantified and for most surveys will make up the bulk of the survey. However, sometimes surveys also have open-ended questions, which is a more qualitative approach where somebody can, you know, fill in the blank or make a short statement. When you think about this new porta potty product, what kinds of thoughts come to mind? And if you have a large enough sample and you're being very fastidious about the research, then you might even attempt to quantify that kind of data by going in and coding every answer so that you first do a rough read through and kind of get an idea of what the major categories are going to be.
Counting keywords.
Yeah. Odor might be a keyword in that example.
And, oh, sure.
you know, so then you might have a lot of open-ended responses that don't exactly use the word odor, but might say smelly, I don't like the way that it smells, you know, variations on the theme. And then that could be coded and counted up. And so something that was sort of qualitative now becomes quantitative. But it's also possible to just think of it along qualitative lines to kind of get a sense of what might be going underneath, something a little bit deeper than might be apparent from just counting things up.
Right.
There's often a complementary relationship between qualitative research and quantitative research. Sometimes before people will do a survey, they want to go out and hear from people, which will help them to understand, well, what are the issues that we should be measuring? And so that's a traditional relationship. But then it also happens the other way around, where people do a survey, a quantitative survey, and then maybe something comes out in an unexpected way. And they say, wow, what's going on with this? Why do people answer this question this way? It seems so counterintuitive. And so then they will want to conduct either one-on-one interviews or perhaps focus groups to dig down and understand what was going on at a deeper level.
Right. So that makes a lot of sense to me, you know, qualitative and quantitative research supplementing each other, sometimes one leading the other. And I do want to talk in the abstract a little more, but before we get to that, you gave me all this information about your own experiences. And I want to bounce off of that a little bit. For example, this idea that you had personal experiences of making an insight in a focus group discussion, you know, writing up a report and seeing some trend that's coming out in the world of technology, and then seeing it bubble up in the news later. I'm curious if you could go into a little bit more detail about that, what sort of trends we're talking about, or what the time delay was. Are you discarding cases where you were wrong?
Well, I probably am discarding cases where I was wrong. So I'm not saying that I'm always right or that qualitative research is unerring, because one can cite examples, as Dan Ariely did, cited a couple of powerful examples where qualitative research led to the wrong conclusion. Mm. And unfortunately, for what I was describing, I'm reaching back so far, I don't remember all the details. And another unfortunate thing is that it's very unusual for clients to come back to me and tell me how they use the research and what results it led to in terms of their decisions, products, success, and so on. So most of the time, I don't get to hear about that. But let me tell you about a recent study that you might find interesting, where I can give you a little bit more specificity.
Sounds good.
Okay. This was a study hired by a company that specializes in targeted marketing information. I don't know how to describe their category any better than that, but they were interested in people who use social networking tools as well as email, who use things like Facebook and email and Twitter, and they were interested in exploring how they could market to those people through those kinds of mediums, through media, through Facebook, through Twitter, through email, and so on. What are people receptive to? What do they expect? What kinds of concerns do they have? And in particular, they wanted us to develop what they called personas. And by personas, they meant to develop some sort of, if you will, archetypes or imaginary persons that would represent a type of person.
So you sort of segment the market with examples.
Exactly. Mm. But not necessarily to do it by age or by income, but more by sort of behaviors, interests, style, things like that. So we came up with quite a few. They were also interested in exploring different online modalities. So we used three different modalities. One was a three-day bulletin board style discussion. This was all text-based, so people went to a special website, and we asked a number of questions each day over a three-day period. And people could go to the website twice a day, to answer the questions, to see how other people were answering the questions, and to interact with the other people who were there.
Okay.
So that's one approach, and sometimes called a bulletin board or a forum or an online discussion, different names for it. Another approach that we used was a text-based real-time chat, where we invited 10 people to come and chat for about 90 minutes, again, all text-based, but this time everybody was there at the same time, and so we could kind of ask follow-up questions and know that they would see them and answer them right away. And the third approach was we did something like the one I just described, except with a video component. So it was a real-time webcam group. Because we did the three-day discussion first, that's the one that came out with the richest data, partly because it was spread out over 3 days and people had a lot of time to kind of think about and type in their answers. And people who do qualitative research, who do online focus groups, my peers, are really trending very strongly towards that kind of group.
Right. That's an interesting way, it seems, to me to get people to think about things more carefully, because even when they're not at the bulletin board, they might be stewing unconsciously over the topic or chatting with people about it. And so you're getting a lot more out of people, it seems to me.
Yeah, and also there are elaborations on that theme. I didn't use them, but they're very elaborate tools that will allow people to upload videos. So you can ask them, you know, to take some videos that represent their activity or their use of a product or their use of a product category or service category over the course of a day or over the course of a week. They can submit photos, still photos. They can leave, you know, voice recordings. There are all sorts of fancy things that can be done along the way.
Right. One thing I like about this example is that the people you're dealing with, the sort of technologies they need to participate, text chatting or being able to upload photos, hypothetically, or just being able to check into bulletin boards on their computer, they're also the more likely to be the sort of people who use social media and are technologically plugged in. Whereas if there were some more mundane question, some product that was offline that you're interested in, you might be skewing things by finding technologically savvy people with laptops and good internet connections.
And all of this is evolving very rapidly. So with the advent of smartphones, you know, people can make videos on their smartphone. They can receive the questions on their smartphone, and the questions can be piped into the bulletin board discussion or the real-time discussion. And it's possible to do either real-time video or asynchronous video that's viewed later. The variations on this are staggering and just exploding, with lots of vendors out there who are offering all kinds of fancy solutions. But getting back to the specific example that I was going to give you, I thought I would run by you the 10 personas that I identified as a result of the research. Mm. And these are names that I used. The client liked the personas and ended up renaming them in some cases, because some of the ones that I chose could have been taken as a little bit pejorative, although they weren't meant to be pejorative.
Okay.
And I can tell you that the client was so taken with this research that they ended up doing a series of white papers that they put out on their own, and then actually wrote a book that played off of this research and did follow-up research later. So here are 10 personas that came out of this, and maybe you'll be able to relate, or your listeners can relate. And probably a person is not just, as with various typologies, you know, you're not just one. You'll see yourself in several, probably.
Makes sense.
One I call the Audrey 2, and I don't know if you ever saw the play in the movie The Little Shop of Horrors, in which there was an ever more hungry plant named Audrey 2 that kept demanding, "Feed me, Seymour. Feed me, Seymour." Did you ever see that movie?
I remember Seymour. I saw a play inspired by the movie, so I understand the concept of a blood-sucking plant.
Exactly. And I think in the original report, I called it the hungry baby. this was an attempt to soften it. So what I was referring to here, to describe those social media mavens who are primarily driven by a voracious appetite for freebies, coupons, discounts, and other sorts of special offers. So these people become fans of like 25 or more brands on Facebook and so on. And they're doing it. Their primary drive is the opportunity to save money and or get free stuff. Okay, so that was one type. Another type or persona that I described, I call the worker bee. And this describes the very business-oriented type of person who's primarily concerned with things like keeping up with business trends, communicating with business contacts, and promoting their own business or that of their employer. So that Facebook, Twitter, email, those are all viewed chiefly as tools to help them in their pursuit of business success. Mm. Does this make sense to you?
Right. So they're not as concerned about liking companies' pages. They might see that as a little more gimmicky or not worth their time, these busy bees.
Yeah, probably more like not worth their time because they're working on building their business, not saving money necessarily. That's not their primary motivation. Now, another kind of persona I characterize as family and friends. This kind of user is primarily interested in such activities as tracking the kids who are away at college or connecting with friends from childhood, staying in touch with high school and or college chums, communication with a close circle of friends, and so on. By the way, these personas were then used in a survey. They did put together a survey to figure out, well, just what are the percentages of how many people are in each of these categories.
Okay, that was what was on my mind.
I don't know the percentages because they didn't share that with me.
Oh, the mystery.
But I do know that part of the purpose of my end of the research was to help them get the lay of the land so that they could go out and create their survey.
So there's an example of qualitative research leading to quantitative research.
Yeah. I'll just quickly flip through the other of the 10, and I won't elaborate on them unless you have a question about one or more of them. So another category was the exhibitionist. Another was the voyeur. Another was the social butterfly. Another was the stimulation seeker, the controller, the switchboard, and the devotee. So those were the 10 categories, and that gives you a sense of, you know, of a way in which qualitative research was used recently by me.
Right. That's very interesting. I mean, one aspect of it is that it's when you give these labels, you can get a lot of information just from the name and from a short description. You start forming an image, you start thinking of people you know, and telling a story based on characters in this case, or just generally speaking in a way that's accessible, seems like it's a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, it's so easy to consume and understand and feel persuaded by. But then there's still this question I want to keep exploring about validity. And of course, one way to get at the usefulness of focus groups is to say, well, I have insider experience and I saw my ideas become big, come to fruition, get accepted by other means.
Well, you know, the big validation in the end is success, is money. How much money is the company making? And so if you look at some of the major brands like, say, Coca-Cola and Pepsi and Walmart, I was just, you know, you mentioned that I was the editor of the Qualitative Research Consultants Association quarterly magazine Views. And they just recently had an article that was very close to, you know, I was talking about personas. They had an article on archetypes, which was fascinating. And they talked about how Coke has an archetype that they characterize as innocence. That should be pretty clear that Coke is all about happiness and sort of upness. And their advertising around that identity has been rock solid throughout their whole history. In this article, they describe how Pepsi strayed off of message. Their archetype was kind of the jester. And they had a whole bunch of humorous stuff. And then they strayed away and tried to kind of copy Coke with a refresh everything kind of theme. And their numbers began to fall right away. ad age at that point declared Pepsi has lost the cola war, and it fell down to third place in market share behind Diet Coke's share. So those kinds of insights about the underlying archetype of a brand, those are developed through the use of qualitative research that often involves what are called projective research, really drawing upon the insights of psychoanalysis and what would be called depth psychology. Now, you may quarrel with psychoanalysis or depth psychology, or maybe even with the ethics of probing into people's, quotes, unconsciousness. But believe me, these major corporations do that. It's like advertising, you know? People like to say, oh, well, advertising doesn't affect me. You know, I see through what they're doing. I'm not manipulated by advertising. And we all kind of have that feeling that advertising doesn't have an impact on us. Believe me, they would not spend the billions and billions of dollars on advertising if it was not effective. And believe me that ad agencies get fired and consultants get fired when those ad campaigns aren't effective, because they are measured in quantitative ways. The bottom line being one of those quantitative ways, and various other kinds of indices, you know, to track advertising effectiveness. So many or most, maybe all, of the insights in those big campaigns, qualitative research plays a major role.
How long has that been the case? Do you have a sense of the history? Because I think it's something that happened in this century, especially in the second half.
Oh, yeah. I think it goes back to around 1940.
World War II, I think.
Somewhere around in that time frame, the 40s, the 50s, there was a famous book called The Hidden Persuaders by Vance Packard that talked about subliminal advertising and got people, everybody got very upset, you know, thinking, oh my God, we're being manipulated. But they don't really need to play it, you know, at a sub-noticeable volume to be effective. They play on our needs and, you know, our needs and emotions and our unconscious and semi-conscious self-concepts and desires and frustrations and so on.
Do you think that all these plays on our unconscious, which I'd agree are effective, I mean, it's hard to quantify, but it definitely seems like a very powerful force. Do you think they also turn around and shape our culture? Or do you think they're more mirroring what people want? What's the balance?
Well, it's, you know, it's not an either or. I think what it is, it's a feedback loop. So both are, you know, both are at work. And certainly we are being influenced by, you know, by advertising and popular media, you know, by so many different factors and forces. And then the marketers and advertisers are always out there trying to mine, well, what's going on in the culture now? What are people into? What are kids into? What are the Japanese teenagers into? You know, and so there's this whole engine that's driving us as a culture. And again, I, you know, as a psychologist, I have lots of questions and ethical questions that I'd want to raise and discuss that we don't have time for here. I'm happy to say that in the market research that I've done, it's not challenged my ethics in a very specific way. You know, I haven't done research for cigarette companies or other companies that I felt were kind of evil in that way. And most of the projects that I work on, there's no sense of trying to manipulate consumers. A lot of the research that I do is business to business. Somebody's got stuff that they sell to other businesses, and they're trying to figure out what are their needs and so on.
Right. Have you had the opportunity to turn down some offer where there was a feeling of moral ickiness around it, or there was some specific evil you saw lingering in it?
I don't remember an instance of that. It seemed to me that there was one that was maybe a close call, but I don't remember it now. I did when I first got started, and I was working for the fellow who I started out with, who was kind of my mentor. And he was doing work for, among others, for some liquor companies. And so there were sort of alcoholic beverages that were clearly being, that were sort of like candy drinks, that where it was clear that the target was to get at a youth market.
Right.
And I have to say I was queasy about that. Hmm. So I was happy to help steer the business away from that kind of work and more to the high-tech realm that I was interested in.
I think I share your base perspective that there's nothing inherently wrong about manipulating our feelings or our unconscious mind, because that our everyday experience does that to us all the time. But then there's specific goals in mind, that like selling a cigarette or a drink to children that might be questionable.
Well, I have questions about, you know, just how ethical is it to probe into a person's unconscious, and to what depth, if you will, because now there are companies out there that are hooking people up to brain scans and to other kinds of physiological measures, you know, to EEGs, to fMRIs, functional magnetic resonance.
Imaging.
Imaging, thank you. And, you know, so they're using that information. Now, it's not clear. There's some controversy about that, in not just in terms of the ethics, but in terms of the effectiveness of it. There are big claims being made for neurological approaches. Assuming that it does work, is it ethical? And I really don't see people raising that question. In this organization that I belong to, QRCA, Qualitative Research Consultants Association, they have a code of ethics. And people in market research, all of the organizations have codes of ethics. But they don't touch on those kinds of ethical issues.
Hmm.
They're more ethical issues relating to, you know, how you deal with your respondents and the kind of relationship that, you know, keeping private information private and the interface that you have with clients and safeguarding their confidentiality and so on. But these bigger ethical questions, they're not in the codes of ethics.
Right. And it sounds difficult to scrutinize, since in some sense we're talking about a difference of degree than of kind, or at least a fuzzy boundary. Like you're saying, how deep is too deep before it's unethical?
Well, very fuzzy boundaries. And also, you know, we're getting into questions of values. Mm. And, you know, and so that gets to be a bit of a slippery slope, since there's no common agreement in our culture about what our values are.
Right. And should there be agreement? I don't know.
I don't know either. I don't have the answer to that. You know, one of the, there were a couple of surprises in that study that I was talking about, the persona study. And one of them that's kind of relevant here is that we were surprised to discover, I was surprised, that's the royal we, I was surprised to discover the extent to which privacy is not a major concern for those people who, you know, become the fans of companies and who permit the email marketing and so on. By and large, they're not terribly worried about it.
Hmm. That is interesting. So it's almost a vindication of Zuckerberg's public attitude.
Well, he's helping to shape that. He's creating that world. And I don't know if it's a good world or not a good world. And Zuckerberg, you know, evidently is far more of an idealist than the movie portrayed. He really seems to hold very early on, as a 19-year-old, the ideal that if the world were completely open, if people were completely transparent, then a lot of the problems would go away. Now, there's a possibility that that's very youthful.
right.
perspective. And then he may change his mind.
And honestly, I've always questioned his idealism as well. Just from seeing him articulated in speeches, it might just be that he's not a very powerful speaker. But also because I saw Time magazine confront him when he was picked as person of the year. I think it was last year. It was in the midst of this WikiLeaks frenzy. And they asked him, well, you believe openness sets the world free. What do you think about setting government secrets open? And I guess he had his hands tied at that point, but he really didn't want to give much of a crumb about the value of openness when he was taken from that angle. It was more, I'm completely separate. I'm a business. I forget exactly what he said, but I feel like he was definitely willing to backpedal there.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, another surprise or wasn't really a surprise, but an observation was the apparent move away from the use of email, at least by some segments. And this is one of those things where this might have been an observation that would have led more widespread awareness. Although it's something that I had been hearing, like on technology podcasts that I listened to, and I was hearing people say that hey, they're using email less and less. And I was noticing that, you know, I'm an old guy and email to me is important. Mm. And I've got these, because of my podcast, I have listeners who, instead of sending me an email, they want to communicate through Facebook. So in my email, I get a message saying, so-and-so has sent you a message on Facebook. So then I have to go and open up Facebook and find out what they said and then answer them there. And I realize the difference is that they're living in Facebook and Facebook is open all the time. Whereas for me, I'm not living in Facebook. I have a Facebook account and I use it mostly to promote my business. So guess which persona I fit in.
Yeah, more of a busy and, yep.
Yeah, exactly. And so I have email open all the time. They have Facebook open all the time. Hmm. So, you know, so that's an observation that I make in my report. And I think, I don't know that it's fully out there yet, but I think that the demise of, I will make a prediction that email certainly going to decline and may go away altogether.
Wow.
So you heard it here first. And if that comes to pass, then you should boost your confidence in qualitative research.
Okay. So specifically, what email is just going to be an inferior way to get in contact compared to other channels.
Right, right. People are texting. So texting is absorbing. Well, the other thing that's kind of going away are what we think of as phone calls. I mean, they won't go away altogether, but clearly many people, and, you know, and it's somewhat related to age. I would say it's fairly strongly related to age, but not universally. But many people are texting instead of making a phone call. And I've got a 40-year-old son who I guess is very youthful because he texts all the time. And that's kind of forced me to get into texting if I want to communicate with him. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of communicating with other people that way now. It's very quick. So between texting, instant messaging, you know, we were alarmed by the brevity and informality of email. Some people were alarmed and concerned about what it was doing to our culture and what the long-term impact would be. Again, this is getting into the bigger issues. And now with the move towards instant messaging and texting, you know, the concerns get even even more magnified.
Right.
What is this going to do for, you know, for the way that people think and their literacy and so on?
And I'm one of those holdouts. I love email and I avoid being available on Facebook. And I'm really fascinated by just the information structure of each medium. So like in email, I feel like emails are a lot more structured. And it's funny to hear you say, well, people felt like they were too short and informal. I guess it's just everyone has different experiences. There's some generational shift in expectations.
Yeah, well, I just visited a friend a couple days ago who needed some help. He needed to be brought back from the hospital. And so I spent the night at his house to make sure that he was okay. And he produced a letter that I had written to him 20 years ago. And I said, oh, my God, that's back in the days when I wrote letters, because I don't write letters anymore. I haven't written anybody a letter in about 20 years. And in this letter, I'm raving about a Radio Shack tablet. I think it was called the Radio Shack 100. And it was, I remember it. It was, this was just when laptop computers were starting to come out, and they weighed about 40 pounds. And they were called a laptop computer or a portable computer. And Radio Shack had this small device that ran on pin light batteries. It had like a 7-line LCD display, but it would run for about 14 hours and widely used. The press immediately started picking them up because it was a great for newspaper reporters. So I was talking about that and how excited I was about that, and how I was able to hook it up to a modem of a certain baud rate, which I described, and how it only took me an hour to get the message that I was typing over onto the computer and to be able to email it to somebody. That's 20 years ago. There were no cell phones. And, and it was a 2-page letter, which is not a terribly long letter as letters go. If you go back historically, people used, and I'm sure I wrote some much longer letters than that in early days. But how many people write letters?
How often would people write a 2-page long email?
Right, exactly. Email has tended to be, has shortened it quite a bit, and also a lot less formal, so that you don't worry a whole lot about typos or about abbreviations. And then, of course, all of that really goes away when you talk about instant messaging and texting.
Well, that'll be very cool to keep following along to see how our communication changes and how we change or don't change as a result. But I do want to end with something related to focus groups again, since we started on that note. And that's this idea that there's feedback between the world of market research and the world of academic psychology. And you mentioned at the beginning that you moved from one world to the other. And in the academic world, from that perspective, it wasn't as clear that qualitative research was valuable and credible. You hadn't heard of it as much. I guess you had training as a psychotherapist, but even psychological researchers just doing their cognitive science or whatever won't necessarily be that acquainted. So just let's look at this idea that there's an interchange that's maybe going more in one way than the other, and why that is or what should be done about it.
Well, actually, qualitative research, I've discovered, has now sort of entered the lexicon of the social sciences. And maybe it was there all along and I just didn't know it. I don't know. But I do know that in sociology and anthropology, for example, that there's some stronger tradition of qualitative research. And even within psychology, particularly people in humanistic psychology, some of the softer side of psychology, who are required to do a dissertation, have discovered that there is a legitimate approach called qualitative research. And we're beginning to see more and more dissertations that are qualitative, at least in some of the alternative institutions that are out there.
So you see the sort of qualitative research you've done as being a more natural fit and having already taken more root in sociology, anthropology, and humanistic psychology, right? But that there might be some realms where just there's always going to be a precedent of avoiding that?
There are two ways of knowing, different and legitimate ways of knowing. And I guess I think of the quantitative approach as an important step of validating qualitative information. But when I think about the big breakthroughs in science, whether we're talking about physics or psychology or some other discipline, it's often comes from an intuitive leap where somebody has a flash of insight. They have a hunch. They have an intuition. And then they may spend years doggedly researching it to finally prove and demonstrate to the rest of the world objectively that their insight was correct. the image that's often portrayed of the scientist, I think, is wrong. The image that I learned in when I was a graduate student and the model of science was being presented, and it was that the scientist has a hypothesis, the scientist tests the hypothesis, and if the hypothesis is not borne out, the scientist discards the hypothesis. In reality, that doesn't seem to me to be how it really works in the real world. What I observe is the scientist has a hunch, the scientist has a hypothesis, the scientist carries out some research, the hypothesis is not borne out, the scientist figures out another way to come at it.
Yeah.
And does another study, or maybe the scientist decides to analyze the data different and to look at, to keep, quotes, mining the data set until it comes out the way that he wanted it or expected it to come out. Or, as I say, just keeps designing different approaches until finally something seems to take him in the direction that he wants to go.
So people are pretty persistent in confirming their intuitions or searching different ways to validate what they started with what their initial insight was, right?
Yeah, and I'm claiming that it all starts with an idea, with an image, with an intuition, with something that's very soft and qualitative.
Right. But then that makes me think about what's can be scary. If you look at focus groups and the moderators who are conducting the groups and then the people who are putting together the reports, we're counting on those people to have good insights and hunches that they're going to pull out the right interpretations from this mass of words and gestures that they're given. And on
yes.
the one hand, I think we can agree that that's very powerful. That can preempt maybe the other slower means of getting at similar information. But we're trusting people and their training and their and what's happening below their consciousness. So it's that I could see how that's just a tough question to get at. How much we should trust these people?
Yeah, and like anything else, there are going to be differences in skill. And skill and native talent and native ability and training and so on, so that some people are going to be very skilled and just almost like seers, you know, in their ability to pull out information. They're just going to be mind-blowingly creative and yet accurate, and others are just going to be kind of run-of-the-mill.
And amid all that, we've got some randomness thrown in.
Yeah, but you know, but the companies, the people who hire these people, you know, they're going to go on track record and reputation and so on. So the cream tends to rise to the top.
Yeah, and so I guess that's sort of our provisional answer to the one of the main questions we started off with. There's not necessarily a scientific quantitative way to gauge qualitative research. The measure of qualitative research is qualitative things like reputation, which companies survive. I guess the money is the closest thing to quantitative, huh?
Well, the money is certainly one. And then, as I say, there are other ways to track it, you know, and large companies do that.
Mm.
But there are a lot of my clients are not large companies. Often my clients are a startup company, and they just want to kind of get a read on what they're thinking about doing, and they want to hear from how some people respond to the concept of what they're about to do, or to get some initial pricing ideas or something like that.
Yeah.
And I guess another reason for why focus groups are still around is because you talked about time and speed, and we all know that the world is moving at a faster and faster clip. And commercial entities need to make decisions very quickly. They've got decisions that are right on top of them. You know, their boss is saying, hey, we got to decide this and we got to know by next week.
Hmm.
You know, are we going to do A or are we going to do B? Well, a focus group can be a really fast way of getting some data. Now, it may not be the best data in the world, but many companies function on the basis of some data is better than no data.
Right. Which is also better than too much data that takes too long, right?
Yeah, right.
which is the thing the academics would not understand as quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's been great speaking with you about focus groups and all kinds of other things. I loved hearing about your avatars, the personas, and all your experiences that help bear on this issue. Hope we'll talk again.
Well, it's been my pleasure. And before I leave, can I say shrinkwrapradio.com?
You sure can. Yep, Shrinkwrap Radio, okay. The premier psychology podcast.
Thank you so much. It's been fun.
Take care now.